Welcome to the City Club of Eugene, November 1st, 2019 program. Is your utility disaster resilient? This is the ninth program of our 2019-2020 programming year, and my name is Eric Richardson. I serve as City Club President. Support for the City Club is provided by our members and sponsors. You can become a member of City Club of Eugene at our website, cityclubofeugene.org. We have both in-kind and diamond sponsors, and today we'd like to acknowledge our diamond sponsors, Kaiser Permanente, affordable health care services to improve the health of our members and communities we serve. For more information, www.kp.org. The University of Oregon. Since 1876, the university has helped Oregon's question critically, think logically, reason effectively, communicate clearly, act creatively, and live ethically. More information at uoregon.edu. And Peace Health. Peace Health is proud to serve Eugene, Lane County, and beyond. As our hometown healthcare provider for more than 80 years, their mission has been to keep you and your family healthy. Learn more at peacehealth.org. And Lane Community College, who transforms life through learning. It provides comprehensive, accessible, high-quality educational opportunities that promote student success. For more information, visit lanecc.edu. Okay, so we're going to move on to today's program. I'd also like, before we do that, we'd like to acknowledge the generous support of our hometown, the City of Eugene, for understanding that the City Club plays a critical role in discourse in our community and bringing people together. So today, I'd like to introduce our program coordinator who has put this show together. Please welcome Randy Prince.
Thanks, Eric. Today we're looking at our utility services. How well do they fare when tested by nature with severe weather, fires, and the less frequent event, earthquake? Are these systems robust enough to help our population withstand these natural events with relative ease, escaping the kind of utter misery experienced by people in less technologically advanced countries when Mother Nature gets out of sorts? Or do our lifelines sometimes make the disruption much worse, turning a mere problem into a disaster? Of course, we'd like to see our utility services completely immune to the effects of nature. A major meteorite crashes to Earth, something like caused the extinction of dinosaurs millions of years ago, and yet we could just go on streaming Downton Abbey, Game of Thrones, or watch the nightly PBS News Hour, warm and dry, refrigerators running, and toilets flushing. We have a ways to go before that's reality. Well, this fall, millions of Californians have been going for days without electricity, something that was intentional on the part of utilities down there. It's to prevent a repeat of what happened in the last couple years when power lines around untrimmed trees sparked fires that killed scores of residents in both cities and rural areas. Thousands are currently under mandatory evacuation orders due to the heat and severe weathers often seen in that state. One term they're using is devil winds. Here in Oregon, we're more likely to have the power go out when it's cold and icy, no less inconvenient, and can be dangerous if one's not prepared. Earthquakes are much less frequent here than in either of our neighboring states on the coast, but not less severe. How will our utility services fare? Will electricity and water be restored within a few days or weeks? Will the gas be shut off before widespread fires are ignited? And then how long will it take to restart the appliances that run on that fuel? Now, regarding earthquakes, Oregon is looking forward to the activation of a seismic early warning system. And last week, here at the City Club, we heard from seismologist Lucy Jones of Southern California, where such a system is already up and running. She was in the news quite a lot after a quake 100 miles north of Los Angeles gave the city a good shake. But no early warning, and a lot of people wished it were otherwise. Well, at what point do you give more warning, preventing the shock and surprise, but perhaps cause a lot of unnecessary work after some services are interrupted? Both of today's speakers represent utilities in Oregon where this could be an issue. Here from the Portland area is Joe Carney, the Senior Director of Engineering at Northwest Natural. Northwest Natural is an investor-owned utility, the state's largest provider of natural gas. It serves 2 million people, including our area. During his 15 years at the company, Joe has managed regulatory compliance, construction, and engineering. He represents the utility sector on the Oregon Seismic Safety Policy Advisory Committee. Rodney Price, our other speaker, is the Chief Operating Officer of the Eugene Water and Electric Board, EWEB. He joined EWEB in 1998 and became the Chief Operating Officer in 2019. Eugene residents know EWEB as the city's primary utility, but it's also responsible for serving a significant rural area and must contend with some of the tree issues there. Rod has over 30 years of electric utility experience, including with the Bonneville Power Administration, Emerald PUD, and Stanley Consultants. And we're going to hear from Rod first. Here he is.
Thank you all for having me here. Thanks, Randy. Full disclosure, I'm an engineer. My title says operations officer, but I'm an engineer, so I don't have the flair that Randy's going to brings to the table. So who listened to Dr. Jones last week? Excellent. Who ran home and has 2 months or 2 weeks of soup prepared in water and electric? Okay, excellent. There are some. So in some ways, EWEB's in the same boat. We know stuff's coming. We know things are going to happen. Dr. Jones has provided a lot of good information and a lot of things. And we've been talking about it and working with this for a while. So the question is, how do you get mobilized? How do you get going on programs? How do you get soup stored and water stored, right? So EWEB as a company has done something kind of cool, and I'm going to talk about something really boring right now, which is our strategic plan. Nobody really cares probably about the paper, you know, how we do our business, that kind of thing. But the strategic plan we have is very important. And the reason I recognize it is because in 2017, we adopted a plan that focuses on resiliency and emergency restoration. And really, again, why do you care about that? The reason is because what it does is it puts our whole company on the same page. It's a focus of our capital planning. It's a focus of our operations. It's also a focus of management. It's a focus of staff level. It's also a focus of our elected officials and our board. So as we develop projects and we bring projects to the board for approval and get money approval, they understand why we're doing it, and they have this connection to this emergency planning and this resiliency kind of thing. So with that, I want to talk a little bit about resiliency and restoration. So we're concentrating on a couple things. So restoration is something that happens right after an event. So we have a snowstorm, we have an earthquake, whatever. Right after an event, we as a utility have to get out there and provide services. Resiliency is something that happens a little bit before, so we pre-plan. We do work ahead of time to withstand fires, earthquakes, volcanoes, whatever's going to happen to us. And it's also about the long-term recovery. So not only, and I think Dr. Jones talked about that a lot, so I won't go into it. So those are the two things we're focusing on. So one of the things that's in the news, wildfires. So I thought I'd just talk a little bit about wildfires specifically. California is experiencing a lot of fires, and some of them are started by electric utilities. And the electric utilities down there have shutoff plans. So what is EWEB doing? So EWEB is learning from our neighbors. I spend a lot of time talking to them. Folks in our utility areas work with them and learn from them. One of the things we're doing is we created some risk maps based on mappings that can figure out the risk in our service territory and in our feeders where we think the most fire danger might be. And so we've taken that step, and no surprise probably for folks, it's in the South Eugene area and in our upriver area. So this spring and summer, early summer, what we've done is we went through every single power line and feeder that we have and did an inspection and extra tree trimming just to make sure that that we're as trimmed back as far as we can in those areas, and we're going to do that more frequently. We also are working with Bonneville Power, which shares some of the risky areas with us upriver, to talk about procedures, shutdowns, and things that they may ask us to do, or that the fire departments and that kind of thing up in those areas. So there's some interagency cooperation going on there. But we currently do not have plans to shut off power ahead of time like they're doing in California. We don't see that as a possibility at this time. So in the water department, so UEB has one single source. We have one treatment plant. That's been a concern of ours now for 15, 20 years, whatever it is. We are currently working on obtaining a second source on the Willamette River. And there's a number of negotiations to go through with all kinds of folks, including the City of Springfield and Springfield Utility Board. But good news is we're really starting to open up those talks and work on that. One of the things we have done, though, out at Hayden Bridge, we've spent a fair amount of money upgrading that facility. We're hardening it, making it more earthquake-proof. We've put more emergency generation out there. We're changing the process. So it's really a more of a hardened system. That's just going, that work's just being completed. The next step now is to move towards our reservoirs in the South Hills and modernize those. Those were built back in the 20s and 30s and a long time ago. So we're going to be earthquake-proofing those and making them more resilient. One of the things Dr. Jones has talked about, and I think it's a pretty well-known fact, our distribution system, so the water, as it flows out, comes to your house, is pretty fragile, it's pretty exposed and pretty vulnerable. It's likely that you won't get water for 2, 3, 4 months, I don't know, 6 months, and we're just not sure, depending on how big the earthquake is and how we can get back. But so one of the things we're doing to address that is we're creating emergency watering stations. So right now we have 5 projects that'll be done by the end of, I'm hoping, February. We already have 2 in place, but basically they're emergency wells. They're well sites that we've set up that with containers and piping and that kind of thing that can be put together with school districts or local neighborhood groups, that kind of thing. And the idea is that they're at Lane County Fairgrounds, schools, Science Center on Autzen, Sheldon Fire Department, in those areas. So the idea is that it's a neighborhood spot where you can walk to, you can take your jug, and you can fill it with water. On the electric side, we're doing some things that we had in the 2016 ice storm. Randy mentioned, we had 24,000 outages, and there are some things we really didn't do very well. One was we didn't communicate with customers very well, and two, we didn't have a very good internal outage management system. So since that time, and with the help of the strategic plan, we have worked on improving that. So during our last storm, we had much better communications with the public, and we've set up an outage map. But really more importantly is we have improved our outage management process and software. And one of the things that we've really worked on, so my boss, Frank Lawson, likes to talk about outages as a jigsaw puzzle. So we had 22,000 outages in the Snowmageddon storm. And what he talks about is you take this jigsaw puzzle and you drop it on the floor. So our job, UEB, is to put all these pieces back together, right? Nobody cares about any piece except their own, right? They don't care if UEB puts the whole thing together. It's all about my piece. He talks about that a lot. So the investment we've made in our software and mapping is a tool to help us get better at that and restoring. Another thing that we're working on is what we call resilient spine. And essentially that is we're creating an electrical connection that's going to be robust, that's going to connect critical loads. So we're working on identifying and doing studies, identifying local generation. University of Oregon, for instance, has a large set of generation available for their facility. So the question is, can we use that? Can we work with U of O? Can we electrically even in do it? But what we want to do is create paths and put money into investing, keeping those paths hardened and ready to go. So critical loads being like a hospital, police, fire, those kind of things. Another thing that's really helping us out is installing smart meters. We found out in the previous storm we had about 10,000 electric meters installed. And so a smart meter, what it does is it sits there, and if it goes out of power, it sends a signal out to the system. So our system now, our software is now set up to take in smart meter inputs and say, hey, you're out of power automatically. That means you don't have to call or text or do any of that kind of thing. The system starts feeding itself automatically. And that was actually very successful. We were very happy with that. Another thing we're working on is aging infrastructure. So one of the things that's been really criticized in California is you know, your infrastructure is old, it's falling down, it's whatever. We have some of the similar problems. There's a lot of stuff that was installed before I was born, which is kind of crazy. And so we're working on that stuff and creating asset management plans, seeing where we can best spend the money, where it's best utilized to reduce the risk the most. One of those areas is undergrounding, and I get this question a lot. Why don't you just underground the whole city? Well, for one, it's very expensive. So typically it costs 4 to 5 times the amount of money to underground a system that it does to take it, serve it overhead. So we just can't go and underground everything. But we can, and we did apply for some FEMA grants in after the 2016 ice storm, and we got approximately $4 million to go in, and we targeted some very specific spots and outage that caused a lot of outages typically for us. And so we've been undergrounding those and hardening those, and we're going to be eyeing projects like that in the future. Where can we get the most bang out of our bucks? Replace old equipment and at the same time make it resilient. And that comes back to our strategic planning again, helping bring that kind of thinking together. So technology is the final thing I'll mention. Shake Alert was the thing that Randy referred to. So Shake Alert is a system that in the area here, University of Oregon is coordinating, and EWEB has provided some sensor sites for it. And basically what it does, though, is that there's sensors all over the western United States, and they sense an earthquake, and then they shoot the signal to a satellite to a central place, and then that central place shoots out the information. So if there's an earthquake in California, we might get, let's say in Redding or something, we might get like a 1 or 2 second warning. It sees the S wave and the P waves coming and sends out the alert, and we've got computers sitting on our dispatch area. And it'll say beep, beep, and there's a earthquake coming. And you might think, well, 1 second, who cares? So actually from a utility perspective, there's a lot I can do in 1 second. For instance, I can shut off generators and start shutting those down, so that'll save the equipment. We can open our floodgates for our canals, for instance, is another thing. Very practically minded, we could open garage doors, start them opening, because if the power goes out, guess what? Your fire truck's stuck in the garage. So we're just starting to, we've had them installed for a couple years. They seem to be working well. We're just starting to work those into our operational procedures and actually in our restoration procedures too. You can tell how big the quake was. That can tell us how many people to send and what they want to do when they get there. And finally, I guess what I want to talk about a little bit is, you know, so what is your part in this? And I asked who's all prepared, right? So our job, of course, the more prepared you are, the easier it is for us to work with folks and get to and make the most efficient use of our planning, I guess I would say. But I really encourage folks to be prepared. And what we're talking about is for 2 weeks. Target a camping trip. You're going on camping trip for 2 weeks. So when you go camping, you got to have a tent. You got to have a place to go to the bathroom. You got to have. You don't need internet, by the way. But I mean, that's debatable. I'll talk to my teenage daughter, but we have, you're not going to have power and water for 2 weeks. What are you going to do? So that's the sort of thought process. If you need some help, you know, what do I need kind of thing, EWEB has a Pledge to Prepare program. It's kind of a cool thing. It sends you emails once a month, you know, go buy this or there's a lot of programs out there. Lane County's got a really good one. There's a lot of resources available for what you need to do to get prepared. The other thing I wanted to throw in real quick is work with your neighbors. Your neighbors are going to be an important resource for you. Your neighbor might have a chainsaw and you might have the water drums, and somebody across the street might have the bike to transport the water down to our Lane County Fairgrounds to get some water. So check in with your neighbors. I think that's really important. The other thing I would say real quick too is I think the best way for us to be resilient in the long run is to work with other agencies. So check with your elected officials. You know, you may not think they're listening, but they do listen. If it's important to you, let them know what's important. You know, if you're willing to spend money on it or whatever your thoughts are, check in with your elected officials. So I'm going to turn it over to Joe.
All right, good afternoon. I appreciate everyone taking some time and giving us a chance to share with what Northwest Natural has done to prepare for natural disasters as a company. You guys are also lucky you're getting two engineers today, which is, I think, a special treat. So, but anyhow, Northwest Natural as a company has been, we've been around for 160 years, and so, thinking about preparing for disasters and responding to disasters is something we think about often. And specifically for like seismic events, we've been spending decades preparing and working to prepare for them. So we don't know what's going to happen in any of these major disasters, but we find planning to be very, very important. And really it comes down to three things. Is we want to make sure we install and enhance our system to be as resilient as possible, just like Rod said with EWEB. Then we want to be able to isolate any problem areas that occur and then restore as quickly as possible. And I'll talk a little bit about how we do all three in the next few minutes. So we've, and like I've mentioned the last few decades, coordinated with a lot of local agencies and how to prepare. We participate in statewide tabletop exercises for natural disasters to kind of test what our plans are. We meet with CERT teams across the state, the community emergency response teams, to help educate them. There'll be force extenders in these types of events. We study events worldwide, whether they're earthquakes in Japan or fires that are happening down in PG&E or up there's recent one in up in Canada, on what worked for them, what didn't work, so we can learn from them and integrate that into our own plans. We've also partnered with like-minded lifelines and utilities like EWEB, BPA, ODOT to fund research at Oregon State to help really specifically to seismic, help us understand the issues that we have here through the Cascadia Lifeline Program. And we find that to be very useful to keep educating ourselves about what could happen and how we can better respond. So I think another important thing to know is that our natural gas system is heavily regulated by the federal government. It tells us what materials we can use, where we have to put shutoff valves, how many we have to put in, what kind of patrols we have to do, kind of inspections and maintenance to maintain the safe, reliable service that our customers expect. And, maybe most importantly too, is we feel our system is very modern. We've spent a lot of time over the last three decades upgrading it. We don't have any more bare steel in our system. We don't have any more cast iron in our system. And what we're left with is a very modern, with a lot of modern materials. And so I've got an example here. I've got about 2.5 feet of half inch poly pipe. And this is the same kind of pipe that will hook many of your homes up, will run from the main in the street to the meter by your house. And it's about the diameter of my thumb. And it's flexible enough that you can get the ends to touch and have almost a circle here. And this kind of flexibility allows, like in an earthquake event, for the pipe to move with the soil movements and withstand the earthquake event. Steel pipe is all equally as flexible. You wouldn't think it. If I had a 2.5 foot of piece of service of the same diameter, I wouldn't be able to bend it. But if we had a couple hundred feet, you would see the floppiness that it has in there. It's still very strong, but it still has the flexibility to move within a large seismic event, which gives it a really an a natural inherent resiliency during a seismic event. So in addition to having a naturally resilient material, we have thousands of shutoff valves installed in our system. Some are automatic, some can be remote controlled, some have to be manually controlled in our system, but we have ways to isolate our system to, if there is a small problem, to quickly isolate that area and shut the gas service off, regardless of what caused the, if it's a third-party damage, an earthquake-related event, or a fire-type disaster. We also have over, we mentioned in the introduction, we serve 2 million customers through 750,000 connections. Over a third of them have what we call an excess flow valve installed, which if there's a damage, if this same piece of pipe that I showed you earlier gets severed for any reason at all, it'll shut the gas off automatically down that piece of pipe. And we're actively installing more and more of these every year. Every new service, every replaced service gets a new one, and we're proactively looking to put them in existing services just to increase the safety of our system. We've also, in the last decade and a half, we've had what we call our Transmission Integrity Management Program and our Distribution Integrity Management Program. And those are risk-based programs where we look at threats to our system, whether it be landslides that could be triggered during either a rain event or a seismic event, or other threats to our system like third-party damage, but a lot of them we might replace, move a pipeline that's in an active landslide area, so if there was to be a seismic event, it wouldn't be impacted and it would allow us to restore service even quicker. So in addition to these, we get into our gas control room. We have managed 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. There's someone monitoring the system, looking at the pressures on the system, looking at the flows in the system to respond to any kind of event that may occur. And in the event of an earthquake or other disaster, we have on-call people available 24 hours a day to respond to these events and first, as I said, isolate the system and then begin repairs as they can. In addition to this, if we get into a larger event, we will activate our Emergency Operations Center. We use an incident command system structure similar to what the fire departments use and such. And so for large events, we will man a room in our corporate office 24 hours a day to quickly respond and deal with the issues that are related to that incident that's at hand. So if there's a large event, we'll make sure that we can are gathering information in a central place, making decisions very quickly so we can respond and remediate as quick as possible. The last thing is for the remediation, I mentioned we have first responders around the clock, but in the event of a large event, we are parts of what we call mutual aid programs, where all the gas companies across the USA and Canada agree that in large events that to share personnel. And we've sent people out, we've sent people to the East Coast this year, to Southern Oregon, but in the event that we had a natural disaster, they would send people, trained gas employees to us to help accelerate the restoration of the service that we provide. So, you know, as I mentioned, you know, we're working to enhance the resiliency of our pipeline system and our facilities. We want to make sure as we upgrade our facilities that we can work out of them as we that we have a place that we can safely work out of as we respond to these events. So our new headquarters downtown will be able, after a large earthquake, be able to still be operational the moment that it stops shaking. And some of our resource centers that we have, like the one we have here in Eugene, has been equally enhanced. And then, I don't want to leave you here with what we're trying to overpromise, but we just want to make sure that we're clear with the facts of how resilient our system is and how much time and effort we really do spend to address these issues and be prepared for them. I don't think anyone knows what a large seismic event is going to bring to this or other disaster, but we want to really be prepared. So maybe more specifically, on the what you guys can do before an earthquake, I'll reiterate what you guys heard last week and what Rod just said. It's really important to start thinking about having a two-week supply of medicine, water, food. I like that analogy of a camping trip for individual preparation that we have here. Specifically for gas equipment, is secure your gas equipment to minimize movement during a quake. A lot of, you know, traditional hot water heaters in an older house might not be strapped in. do things like that in advance. Replace the semi-rigid gas connectors with flexible connectors, so it has a little bit of flexibility, so there's less of a chance of a break point there. And move combustibles away from your appliance, so there's no chance of anything spilling there and causing an issue. After an earthquake, check your equipment, make sure nothing flammable has fallen around it. If you do smell gas, you know, our message that we say, smell, go, let us know. If you smell gas, get away. Move away from the structure and let us know. We'll be available to come respond as quickly as we can. I do want to say, though, after like a large event, it's not necessarily you need to turn your gas service off just because there's been earthquake shaking. The system is very resilient, but if you do hear gas or smell gas, you guys can educate yourself in advance. On our website, there's how you can shut off your meter. A lot of the CERT teams we do training on, but if you feel safe, you can turn your gas off, or like I said, give us a call. But if you do turn it off, don't turn it back on. Wait for us to come out, and we'll make sure everything is safe to turn it back on. I think that takes all my time, so thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Joe, Rodney. So we're going to take a 5-minute break so you can formulate your questions, and then we'll be right back. Thanks a lot.
Good evening. You're listening to City Club of Eugene on KLCC, Eugene 89.7, KLCO Newport 90.5, KLFR Reedsport 89.1, and at 88.1, KLFO Florence, KMPQ Roseburg, and KLBR Bend. KLCC is a service of Lane Community College. You can find all City Club of Eugene programs on our website, klcc.org.
Welcome back to the November 1st, 2019 program. Is your utility disaster resilient? Before we proceed, I'd like to recognize our gold sponsors today. Arriving by bike, Evans, Elder, Brown, and Schubert. Commercial Real Estate, and Homes for Good. Now please welcome back Randy Prince.
Our first question, come on up.
Thank you for this topic. The League of Women, I'm Becky Gladstone, City Club member, also president for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. We do support seismic preparedness. I really appreciate that we're having this program. I would like to ask, if we have a big earthquake, we have gas. We have gas heat. We have gas hot water. We have gas cooking. I'm assuming I'll just have to go turn it off. But if I don't have to turn it off, if we can keep using it, that would be really nice. So I understand there are ways to tell, for you to tell, if there's a break in the line. If you can speak to us about how we can tell or what we should do, if there's a system where, oh, we can detect that, but does the detector work if the power is out?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a great question. Again, Joe Carney, Northwest Natural. The best detector that's going to work with the power on or off is your nose. We odorize the gas to at a very high level, so it can be sensed at a very low level of gas. If there's a break, you'll smell it first. If you hear it, that's another kind of indicator using your senses. And if you hear either of those two things, smell, go, let us know. Get out of the house. If you feel safe, you can shut your meter off. And there's instructions on our website pointing out which valve to do it. But I would rely on those two things after an event. But there's a good chance, depending on where the earthquake is and how severe it is, that your service will be just fine as well. So.
Mary Layton, a City Club member. We have related questions from our table. What happens to that lovely bendable yellow pipe if there's a tug, not a wiggle? And how do you find breaks if lines are buried?
Both good questions. So when we install it in the ground in the ditch, we leave it with some slack in it. So it does have a little bit of give in it. It's not at tension, if you will. And then as far as finding breaks or leaks, I mentioned we have a lot of regulation. Depending on the size of the pipe and what pipe it is, either every quarter or every couple of years, we patrol every single piece of pipe that we have with the sensitive instruments to look for super small leaks on up. And we do that on a regular maintenance basis. After a large event, we'll do that for the impacted area immediately after to make sure that it's still tight, and there are no leaks.
Do we have a comment from eWeb about detecting leaks and breaks in your lines? Not gas, but...
Right, so this is Rod Price from eWeb. Generally, when you have leaking water, it's coming up and you know it. So we typically, no, that's not true, too. We do have a lot of areas that are leaking. We do have some losses, but typically, if you don't have water pressure, you'll know it and you'll be able to call us. So.
Hi, I'm Marty Wilde. I'm City Club member since 2010. I'm also a state representative on the Water, Power, and Emergency Prep Committee, so I figured I should probably ask a question. We've been talking a lot about hazardous algal blooms and the problem they had in Salem, so I thought I'd ask Mr. Price, is there a plan? Do you think, are eWeb's water supplies up the McKenzie particularly vulnerable to that, and how would you detect and respond to a bloom?
Yeah, excellent question. So. Yes, they are a hazard. They're a potential hazard. So we've got a source protection program that goes all the way up the McKenzie. So the reservoirs are monitored. We have folks that take samples all up and down the river. Of course, we take samples right there at the intake. We take samples at the outgoing. And any detection upriver is monitored. We watch it come down the river. So we keep a pretty close eye on it. This year was much, we didn't get much activity at all, but the previous year we did get some activity, and of course Salem got hit really hard, so.
Thank you. Yep.
Hi, I'm Steve Robinson, City Club member and president of Cascadia Prepared. I have here an imaginary $10 billion check that I want to give Rodney. And the reason is that we know that when the Cascadia quake occurs, that the damage to our local economy is going to be much more than $10 billion. And we also know that every dollar you spend on mitigation to reduce the damage, pays off quite handsomely in terms of the reduction of the amount of damage that's done. So here's the check for $10 billion. And I want to know, you have two ways you can spend it. You can spend it on mitigation, on getting us prepared so that the 2 weeks ready is enough, you know, that we can actually survive if we only have 2 weeks, which is right now a serious question. Or you can give it to the community. So how are you going to spend that $10 billion? Are you going to spend it on mitigation, or are you just going to give it to the folks?
This is Rod from eWeb. That's an interesting way to phrase that question, and I'm sure Joe will have an answer as well. You said $10 billion, right? I could use $10 billion, no worries. I can spend it on, so what we would do, one of the things I'd really like to do is spend it on the community ahead of time. Because it's not only agencies that have to get together, it's private businesses. There's a whole host of things that we can do ahead of time. You know, what are critical infrastructures? What are critical needs? You know, I have my opinions what they are, but we really need to work with the community to figure that out. You know, I kind of was proposing the idea that everybody gets prepared for 2 weeks or 2 months or whatever. Not everybody in the community can do that, so there's some opportunity there to use some of that money. Hardening of infrastructure, of course, is one of the biggest things in our water systems, number one. So I would work the hardest on the water structure and making sure we've got power. Wastewater is another that we would need to look at and work with the agencies. Those are, you got water coming in, you got to have the stuff going out. So those are big opportunities there as well. And I think the working with the local sources of generation would probably be my third place to spend that money to make sure that we can actually use that and get it to work for us here. Because if we have that Cascadia thing, we won't be getting fuel from Portland. We won't be getting power from Portland. And so we are still working with Bonneville Power to figure out how they can work with us locally from, like, say, Hills Creek or Lookout Point, some of those kind of things. So. Basically, what my response here is, and just to kind of echo, I think, with Dr. Jones, we find that if you spend, you know, it's either, there's ratios of all the way, it's a 6-to-1 less cheaper to spend money up front than it is on the back end. So that's my, I guess my take on your question.
You know, from the from my perspective, you know, we're asking how would we want to spend, you know, the citizens of Oregon's money to prepare for that? And there's a couple. I think we it's not an either or. It's definitely a we need to do both. When Northwest Natural replaced its cast iron and bare steel, it worked with the Public Utility Commission to create a very innovative at the time method where we were spending some money to replace that pipe, and they allowed us to accelerate our investments so we could more quickly get rid of it. And something similar like that for seismic preparation would be an excellent investment, I feel, where we could continue to put additional shutoff valves in, move our pipelines out of where we think high-risk areas for seismic. But then as I also think about it, you know, sitting on OSPAC, the Oregon Seismic Safety Policy Advisory Committee, is there's a lot of education that needs to go out there, and it's hard to find funds for that. There's a lot of structures that need to be hardened so people have shelters, investment in schools and stuff, so we can make sure that, you know, kids are safe if there's a large investment. So, I mean, this is a big enough problem that we need to find a way to do both to really be prepared.
Camilla Pratt, City Club member. My question is for Joe. Okay. The gas system.
Yeah.
Is there a way, if you have a seismic event of substance, and let's say South Willamette or College Hill or Coburg Road area is affected, seriously, is there a way to shut off the supply to that area? To reduce,
I mean, and I don't know the specifics of our Eugene pipeline network very, very well.
Yeah.
But you know, if there was a big event and a large part of Eugene was largely impacted, we would go to what we call our gate stations, and there's, you know, three or four points where a lot of the gas enters the Eugene area, and we would shut that off there, kind of as a holistic response.
That's comforting.
Yeah.
I'm Jack Dresser. I was a member of the group that lobbied very strongly against smart meters. And for several reasons, not the least of which was a statement by General Petraeus when he was head of the CIA that the federal government planned to use smart meters to spy on American citizens. So I want to know how much smart meters are really going to contribute to the response time and efficiency in the case of a natural disaster.
That's Rob Price from the UWEB again. So smart meters are doing a couple things for us, but one of the things they really do is, first, they send the signal that, hey, my house is out. And if you have enough of them out there, they also coordinate to say, hey, this house, and this house is out. Oh, so it must be this point where the failure is. So we can get to the points of failure quicker. So that's a piece. The other piece is, though, they also send the message back saying, hey, we're back in power. And a lot of times what we do is we have to call people, we have to go out and verify some of that kind of things. And also a lot of times what happens is people want to know when their power is going to come back on. And we can't always answer that, but sometimes we can. Hopefully, part of the function of smart meters eventually is to put products in people's hands and apps and different information pieces about their particular house and their particular power and their piece of that puzzle so that they can do some monitoring of it. So
thank you both for being here today. Oh, I'm sorry. Did you want to answer that?
Yeah. Smart meters for the gas in the gas industry aren't quite as far along as they are for the electric industry, but it's they are making big improvements. We were meeting with Osaka Gas recently, and one example, all their meters are smart, and they have seismic sensors in them and the ability to shut off, you know, by using the data that's collected right at the meter there. And that's something that, you know, could be a big benefit to customers here in Oregon. The other thing is that we find a lot of our customers like having that information to know how their house is really using energy, and it really helps with like demand response and energy efficiency programs, having that more data, so.
Thank you. Sandra Bishop, City Club member. This is a question for both of you. It has to do with communications and restoration. So it's easy to say, oh, you know, if your service is out, if gas is out, just call. Well, is EWEB going to prioritize routing their electricity to cell towers? So what's the, for both utilities, what's the plan for restoration? How do you decide in a major event where you restore power for EWEB and gas service for Northwest Natural?
Yes, this is Rod from EWEB again. That's a great question, and you touched on a piece of the industry that I think has been under involved, at least from a planning perspective, which is the cell phone industry. But I would also tell you, we've been reaching out and working with them, and they are also some of the most forward-thinking and aggressive in their ability to restore service because they're wireless. So they have the ability to go out and set up temporary facilities and provide service in places I've been pretty surprised that I've seen pictures and talked to people about. So I think the you're right, communications is a really important piece of information that is a part of the opportunity to spend some extra money on in that coming up in the future, though. But cell phone companies, is we're reaching out to them. I'm going on a tour next week of the Verizon facility, for instance. How do we prioritize services? That was their main interest. Both AT&T and Verizon have been with us. We've got a whole lot. We know all their loads and their sites. We've got phone numbers for all their folks now. They've got our phone numbers. They are keenly interested in making sure their sites are up and running from shore power, because they can't always have backup generators. And it's the same with the radio sites in the area.
Good question. Very similar, and you know, we'll try and prioritize and work with people. But I'll go back to our emergency operations centers. When we do our tabletop exercises, we'll also do them with like the City of Portland, with the State Emergency Management Committee. So we're tied into what's the bigger needs of the community. And that's how it will help us also prioritize where we restore service. If we get a request from the state or a local city or county government that this is our shelter, this is where we need gas service, that's where we'll focus on. But we'll use that EOC to help drive that, because there's so many variables in that and what could occur in a big disaster.
I'm Paul Thompson, a City Club member for some time. I'm also a retired engineer, so I would ask the audience to avert their eyes while we exchange the secret grip. This question is similar to some of the previous ones, but maybe coming at it from a different direction. You've told us in glowing terms a lot of the things that you have been doing, and we're impressed with that. But I know the world of engineering is full of trade-offs. There are places where you've rolled the dice just because you have limited resources to be able to do things. Give us, lift the kimono a little bit. Give us some insight into things that you are rolling the dice on because you don't have sufficient resources that you wish you could do.
That's an interesting question, and I'm not sure I thought it'd be that kind of party. But I think a lot of, you know, what it comes to mind with that is we've learned a lot about seismic resiliency in the last two decades, maybe even the last decade. And a lot of our facilities are, you know, older than that. They're in the 40, 50, 60 year way. And we're looking at maybe replacing some of those crossings or enhance them to make them more resilient. It'd be really nice to have some support to be able to accelerate that. The Oregon Resiliency Plan said, State of Oregon should take 50 years to become more resilient and ready for an earthquake. Why does it have to be that long? Could we come up with some creative mechanisms to make that 25 years or even quicker? And so I think it's could we go back to our historic things and bring it to today's standards even quicker?
Yeah, this is Rod again. So my answer really goes back to aging infrastructure. We have a lot of old stuff, and I would like to get it replaced for various reasons. So we do, what we're doing is basically prioritizing the old stuff that gives us these multiple wins, if you will. So if we have a resilient structure that's part of our resilient spine, that's the area of town we're targeting first, or or the lines, that kind of thing. Undergrounding is another example. We could do a lot more of that, for sure, where we need to. It doesn't solve all the problems, of course, but it does take care of a lot of reliability things. So it's mostly an aging infrastructure. There's more out there than we can replace with the budgets and constraints that we have. But resiliency is really a good driver and a good provoker of conversations around which ones to do and which ones to target. So,
John Dello, City Club member, and I got a couple of quick questions. One is, I've heard different statistics on how much power this Springfield, Eugene area gets from Bonneville. Could you fill us in on that? And also, how secure is your computer system against hacking and things like that?
Yeah, that's an awesome question. So I'll start with computers first. The cyber threats are actually one of the biggest. We haven't even talked about cyber here, but if you look at our emergency operations and like Northwest Natural, we've got all these ICS operations and mutual aids and all these kind of things. But cyber is a large component of our emergency response set. So we have been investing heavily in simplifying our networks. We've been investing in cyber resiliency. I can't remember if the IS manager was here. There's like 100,000 hits a day. You know, it's kind of crazy how much stuff goes at our system, but we're by lots of regulations, water and electric, they have requirements around cyber resiliency, so you can't hack into the electric system or the water system, those kind of things. So there's a good deal of attention that's focused on that. Your other question was around how much power. I'm not quite so roughly, I want to say EWEB gets most, I want to say 70-80% of our power from Bonneville, and we power trade and buy and sell on the market because we have our own generation as well. I'm going to say 20% on any given moment. Springfield, I think, is 100% Bonneville dependent. So,
question for EWEB. I'm Ruth Demler. I've been concerned a long time about the plume that you have from the creosote plume that was been there for many years. And I understand the plume has now gone into just before the intake in the McKenzie River. And I was wondering, would that be affected by an earthquake? Would it enlarge all of a sudden? And how is it being taken care of? Because I'm so pleased with what you're doing about water and your new additions that you have. I visited one of them and they're just excellent, your emergency water. But I'm concerned about also the plume and how it's entered into the water system. It was from Weyerhaeuser and creosote
okay.
plume.
That's that what one. I was going to guess at, right. It's a great question. John? That plume from Weyerhaeuser is very closely monitored by the DEQ. We do keep our eyes on it. It is, I just read the report on that, and we're going to put it out here pretty quick. But in essence, it's not getting worse. And we do, at least in the wells near where our intake is, and that's all I'm going to say because that's all I can remember. But we do monitor it very closely. It is a factor that we can deal with in our intake as well.
Would an earthquake make a difference?
Well, I'd have to think so, because anytime the ground shifts, you know, you just don't know what's going to come of that. So, but the problem's a known problem, and it's monitored by a lot of people. So,
Randy Prince, your moderator here, our presenters and our questioners have done a great job of being concise and to the point. I think since we have a little time left, and I'm going to ask a question about liability. How does our picture in Oregon differ from that in California, where the company, the provider with those power lines that sparked the fires incurred such damages they had to be rescued, they were unable to cover the liability. The accountability is so stringent that many tree cutters who would do the work to make things safer are backing off because they don't want to take on that kind of responsibility. Perhaps there's some, obviously there was an adjustment when they said they were too big to fail. How's our picture different here, and who would pay if, for all of the good work and the good intentions that you, both of you have described, something went wrong and you were held liable, who covers it? Recognizing you're both engineers and not lawyers.
Perfect. Thank you, because I was just going to say that. No, so California, so I'm going to give you my bird's eye view of it, right? California and two other states have what they call reverse indemnity, which leaves the, how do you want to say it? It leaves the anybody involved in the accident or event or whatever it is liable. So in the case of the power companies, for instance, if a car hits a pole and it falls down and starts a fire, the power companies is liable for that. And different laws in different states treat this different, but there's only three. So what that has happened, caused to happen in California is all the liability from anything to do with the electric has come back to, say, PG&E, for instance. They've had some gas issues as well, which I can't speak to a lot. But and they've got different regulatory structures and all that. But anyway, Oregon and Washington are not in that same category. Who covers the cost? So if EWEB is liable for in that fault, EWEB ratepayers, we pay it. If they're not at fault, then there's all kinds of claims and lawyers and things that happen. But basically, EWEB's a combination of self-insured and that we have a large, I can't remember what the word for it is, but for very large things, we're covered as well. Reinsurance, yeah.
You know, I'm not sure there's much more to add from Northwest Natural's perspective. It's such a different regulatory environment in California that doesn't exist here. But if there was a big event, they would dig into what occurred and assign liability that way. And we're also a self-insured company with reinsurance. But it's such a different world, California to Oregon, that it's really hard to draw much parallels on that specific question.
Okay, thank you. I guess that really wraps up today's program and question session. I'd like to thank Randy for bringing this program together. And before we thank today's speakers, I'd like to just acknowledge some of our in-kind sponsors, KRVM 91.9 Radio, PAC Info, and Simplified Computing LLC, Dot Dotson Photography, and Network Charter School, and to public radio station KLCC 89.7 for airing the City Club programs on Mondays at 6:30 p.m. And thank you to Community Television of Lane County, Cable Channel 29, for televising recent City Club events. Next week, we will have a panel discussion on the impacts of homelessness in our community and the ways that we can address the underlying causes. How do disagreements about the root causes of homelessness impede policy design? As public servants and elected officials debate whether an overpriced housing market or challenging personal circumstances contribute more significantly to the crisis. Bob Cerence, will host a panel discussion with Joaquin Alfries, Mark Duthit, and EPD Chief Chris Skinner. Please join us next week for that important conversation. We are also asking for your help. In December, we'll have our Gifts to the City program, and we want your ideas on speakers. This is your chance to help us formulate an upcoming program. So please bring your ideas to Joel, Silver, or myself. This is the final week for your input. More details and information about future programs can be found online at the City Club's website, cityclubofeugene.org. You also can give us any ideas about future programs you'd like to see us speak about. So now let's thank today's speakers, Rodney Price and Joe Carney. Thank you both. This concludes today's program. Thank you and see you next week.